This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
At the core of the problems of South Africa is the landlessness of the black majority and Africans in particular. Without the land, you won't be able to economically empower the black majority.
That's Floyd Sivambu, deputy leader of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Party, on a proposed amendment to allow the state to take land without compensating owners. Details coming up. And Morocco's voters dealt the ruling party a crushing defeat in yesterday's regional and municipal election. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Amid international condemnation of the military takeover in Guinea, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, demanded a return to constitutional order and the immediate release of President Condé. The 15-nation group suspended Guinea's membership and agreed to send a high-level mission there as soon as today. But it has not announced any immediate economic sanctions against Guinea, as it imposed against Mali following a coup there a year ago. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the possible impact of these actions on the coup leaders.
It sends an important signal that this is not going to be tolerated and this is not the way that leaders should be replaced. And so in that way, it provides some action to back up the condemnation that followed the coup. But I think we'll just have to wait and see now what happens and how determined the ECOWAS will be. The coup leaders will likely try to outlast ECOWAS and test their determination. And given ECOWAS's faltering record in standing up to coups in Mali and Chad in the past 12 months, there's good reason to doubt their resolve. But I think it's important stand. It's an important moment for ECOWAS if they expect to be taken seriously and if they hope to prevent the norm of coups from returning to Africa and in West Africa. You know, recall that we had not seen a coup in Africa for many years prior to this recent spate. And so I think what happens here will have broader implications for governance standards on the continent. And let's remember that, you know, the track record of governance in Mali under military governments and in Africa more generally has been terrible. And so we should not be looking to militaries to come in and solve the problems of these countries, or in this case, in particular in Guinea.
The U.S., the U.N., the European Union, and the African Union condemned the military takeover and demanded a return to constitutional democracy in Guinea. Would that force the coup leaders to reconsider their action?
I think on its own, it will not cause them to reconsider. However, if they sustain and remain cohesive in that position and can join ECOWAS in insisting that the coup not be recognized, then I think it can make a difference. In the end, the coup leaders need international recognition for them to operate. You know, they won't have access to financial markets. They won't have diplomatic courtesies. And so they need that international recognition. And, you know, I think at the same time, as the international community talks about constitutionalism, they have to take into consideration that the way Condé himself retained power last year is also a matter of concern. He was able to avoid the restrictions on a third term and effectively orchestrated a fraudulent election last October. You know, the parallel vote counts that were very credible showed him losing that election. And there was evidence of, you know, up to 2.5 million ghost voters and other deficiencies. Yet his declared victory was tolerated by the international community. And so I think that is what is at the root of the instability we're seeing now. There had been massive protests trying to prevent Condé from staying on for a third term in Guinea prior to the election. And there remains a lot of opposition to his rule now. And so as ECOWAS international community look at reinstating Condé, which I think is the way of returning to a constitutional order, they also need to look at how do you remedy Condé's own lack of legitimacy. And, you know, I think this is going to entail some sort of international investigation and some proposals for change, including potentially a rerun of that election, you know, similar to what we saw in Malawi and Kenya when there were fraudulent elections. And I think that then will help Guinea return to a constitutional order and reinstate a leader that is popularly seen as legitimate.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. Morocco's voters dealt the ruling Justice and Development Party, PJD, a crushing defeat in yesterday's regional and municipal elections, as the Islamist group won only 12 seats in parliament, down from 125. The PJD has been the dominant party for a decade. The biggest winner were two parties that are considered close to the monarchy and are likely coalition partners. The National Rally of Independence, or RNI, which is led by Agriculture Minister Aziz Akanouch, considered by Forbes to be the richest person in Morocco, took 97 seats, according to preliminary results, followed by the Authenticity and Modernity Party, PAM, with 82 seats. PAM was formed in 2008 by Fouad Ali El Hima, a personal friend of King Mohammed VI and one of his close advisors. Turnout was 50.35%, according to the Interior Minister, higher than the 43% at the previous legislative polls in 2016, but lower than the 53% during the 2015 local elections. This year's voting was held under new rules and restrictions that analysts say were expected to make it much harder for the Islamist PJD to remain as the biggest party. Hanai Bezad is a reporter based in Rabat. She joined International Edition's Jackson Mfunganye via phone on her way back from casting her ballot.
So today in Morocco, three elections were held, municipal, regional, and parliamentary elections. So people were invited to vote on those three elections all at once, because historically, participation for parliamentary elections was lower than regional and municipal. And there was a lot at stake to make sure that more Moroccan people would actually vote, because the government and the head of the government is decided based on the number of seats parties get at the parliament.
Okay, and how was the turnout this time around? How was it affected by the pandemic?
So it's, to be honest, it's very surprising and positively surprising. But it seems like the level of participation is at 50.18%.
Is that better than previous elections? Does that compare
yes,
to previous ones?
It is better than previous elections, but one needs to say that the rules have changed substantially. Basically, the changes are that seats are now granted based on the number of registered voters rather than the number of those who actually cast the ballot. Okay. And the reason for this change in the process is because it is believed that it's meant to be reducing the level of influence of the Islamist party that has been in power for the last 10 years, basically, the PJD, Parti de la Justice et du Développement.
Okay, and how long was the campaign period?
So the campaign was limited to 15 days. So only the last week of August were parties were allowed to campaign openly. And that, of course, limits the extent of the democratization process that is meant to be sustaining, I mean, these momentums of democratic expression. It's probably linked to the pandemic, but it's also linked to many other strategies at this point.
Okay. And speaking to, you know, what were you hearing about? What are some of the motivations, issues motivating people to turn up to vote this time around?
I mean, historically, Moroccans have been very reluctant to vote in general. And I mean, you know, Morocco has been avoiding and masterfully killing the efforts of some collectives back in 2011 when in other countries in the Arab world, there were uprisings. And so they changed the constitution. And that's how basically the regime became more of a parliamentary monarchy, but eventually turned out to be at the advantage of the Islamist party. And they have been leading the government for the past 10 years. There were 30 plus parties that were competing. So it's a lot. I believe in 15 days is absolutely, I mean, it makes it very hard for average citizens to dedicate this time to compare programs, understand fully the strategy of this or that list, and vote in full awareness.
That was reporter Hanay Ebezad in Rabat, Morocco, speaking with VOA's Jackson Mfunganyi. In South Africa, a parliamentary committee controlled by the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, has begun a process to amend the constitution to allow the state to expropriate land without compensating owners. The amendment, if eventually pushed through, will give the government the legal power to confiscate land in the public interest. As Darren Taylor reports, many South Africans do not trust the state's motives, and opposition parties describe the move as an attempt by the ANC to win popularity ahead of upcoming local government elections.
During the colonial era and apartheid, the best land was reserved for white people. Black people were confined to impoverished townships in the cities. In the rural areas, they were generally allocated inferior land to farm. When the ANC came to power in 1994, fair land distribution was one of its primary promises. It also vowed to create a new class of successful commercial black farmers to work alongside South Africa's white farmers. But the ANC's land reform program has been characterized by corruption and mismanagement. The party has itself described it as a failure. To cover up this failure, say opposition parties, President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration now simply wants to confiscate land to give to whoever it wants.
Today is a great day for the people of South Africa, both black and white.
The ANC's Mathole Motsekga is chairman of the committee seeking to change the country's constitution to allow land expropriation without compensation. He says this will finally result in equality in land ownership in South Africa. Floyd Shivambu, deputy leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, says this is long overdue.
At the core of the problems of South Africa is the landlessness of the black majority and Africans in particular. Without the land, you won't be able to economically empower the black majority and Africans in particular, because as things stand, 80% of South Africa's land is owned by less than 5% of the population, whilst the 80% of the population, which is the Africans, are congested in less than 13% of the land.
In fact, the government is already the biggest landowner in the country, but over the years, it's only redistributed a small portion of this to black citizens. This is what the state's critics refer to when they ask why it doesn't first dole this land out to deserving farmers and others. The amendment needs the support of two-thirds of parliament to become law, a majority it doesn't currently have. Motsekga insists he isn't concerned about the amendment's future.
It is not dead in the water. We expect that all political parties represented in parliament understand that they are there because the people put them there. Any political party that respects the people of South Africa will see the importance of voting for this bill.
But most parties say they won't agree to anything that endangers the rights of citizens to own property and empowers the government to seize land. The ANC is adamant it won't abuse its power to take people's land without paying them for it.
So state custodianship doesn't mean nationalization, and it doesn't mean that the state must own the land and turn the citizens into tenants in the land of their birth.
But many remain concerned about the ANC's land plans. For a glimpse into South Africa's future, they point across the border to Zimbabwe, where President Robert Mugabe's government seized farms owned by whites. Most of the best land was given to officials of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Agriculture collapsed and food shortages remain common. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Authorities in Cameroon say they are trying to remove thousands of children working in gold mines along the country's eastern border. Some of the children were displaced from the Central African Republic because of violence there and dropped out of school to mine gold for survival. Boki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Kambele, Cameroon.
The 2021-2022 school year in Cameroon started Monday, and Cameroon's Ministry of Basic Education says thousands of children have not returned to class in areas along the border with the Central African Republic. The government says many of the children prefer working in gold mines. Oberlin Daudu Melesa is mayor of Baturi, a town on the border. Melesa says his district wants all children to immediately leave gold mining sites and go to schools. He says village chiefs and religious leaders in Baturi have been asked to visit all houses, markets, farms, churches, mosques and mining sites to tell everyone that without education, the future of children looks barren. Mbeleza says at least 300 of the children and teenagers are Central African Republic citizens displaced by violence and insecurity following the CAR's December 2020 general election. Among the kids who have refused to leave mining sites is 15-year-old Joseph Gumba. Gumba says he fled from the CAR in January when rebels attacked the town of Basangwa to protest the re-election of President Faustin Archange Kanje Touadéra. He says he relies solely on gold mining for a living. Gumba says education is the best thing a child can be given, but his preoccupation is to raise money and send to his poor mother, whose old age could not permit her to escape from the CAR. He says his father, who escaped with him, died in a gold mine in July, and he has no one to count on for food and school needs. Gumba says he earns $4 after 24 hours of work. Cameroon says there are over 400 mining sites on its eastern border, a majority of them illegal. Corinne Vondo is a government labor official in Baturi. She says Cameroon will punish people who stop children from going to school. She says Cameroon is a signatory to the worst forms of child labor convention, which was adopted by the International Labor Organization on June 17, 1999. She says a 2011 Cameroonian law states that people involved in child labor are liable to prison time of 15 to 20 years and fines of up to $20,000. Life in the gold mines is dangerous. The government says 27 miners died in May due to landslides. Cameroon has promised to offer free primary education to children who leave the mines, but some of the children say they lack food and books. The government has not said if it will provide those things if the children return to school. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kambele, Eastern Cameroon.
The world's oceans, once viewed as too big to deplete or destroy, are in crisis for many reasons, including climate change, illegal fishing, and pollution. There are also horrific crimes committed against workers in the high seas, much of which are outside the specific legal jurisdiction of any country to police and beyond the political will of many policymakers to correct. The vast intersection of ocean environmentalism, labor, and human rights are the subject of a new book, Outlaw Ocean, Journey Across the Last Untamed Frontier by Ian Urbina. Urbina is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who has formed the nonprofit Outlaw Ocean Project, shed light on the wild, watery frontier. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
You know, the two-thirds of the planet that's water is this realm that rarely gets covered journalistically, and it's existentially important to the planet, but also 50 million people work out there. And for all of these reasons, we try to tell stories about human rights, labor, and environmental abuses that are occurring offshore.
That's a lot of so-called ground to cover.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the space, it's sprawling and hard to police. The high seas in particular are jurisdictionally complicated. It belongs to everyone and no one, so no government really takes responsibility. The nature of the people that work in the space are often migrant, trafficked, undocumented labor from developing nations. For all these reasons, abuses are more common and often occur with impunity, since there's very little investigation or prosecution happening about the crimes out there.
Who are the main victims of those crimes?
The foremost victim of crimes out there is the ocean itself, and the crimes range from intentional dumping to unfettered, unregulated mining. More than 80% of the world's fish stocks are at or beyond the point of collapse. They've been overfished. You also have a rampant problem of illegal fishing. One in five fish that end up on the average person's plate comes off of a pirate vessel. By 2050, some research says there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish. So the state of affairs at sea are pretty bleak.
Then there's the horrific human element. It's just one example in your book. You describe a foot wound on a crew member aboard an illegal Chinese fishing vessel. The guy's foot had been cut by a catfish whisker.
His foot got extremely infected, and when we boarded the vessel to inspect it for other crimes, he kind of came out of the woodwork and showed us his foot. It was so swollen and the skin so tight, it looked like a oozing eggplant. We had a doctor come on board and try to dress the wound, but the guy didn't have any footwear to keep that foot dry, and he was just going to go back to work. So that gauze and such would just, you know, soak in the nasty detritus that lines the fish deck anyway.
Was he there of his own free will? I know a great many workers have been kidnapped or enslaved.
No, those guys, from what I could tell, were not debt bonded or shanghaied, or they're making woefully low wages. It's pretty shocking, but most of them have a contract of sorts and they're working, you know, 2-3 month rotations and then they go to shore. The living conditions on the boats were just abysmal, but they were not debt bonded as you find, say, on the South China Sea.
Tell me about your Outlaw Ocean Music Project. I know that it partly helps pay for your investigative journalism and your nonprofit, which are very expensive to support.
It's this global effort that started a year ago where we recruit musicians, be they hip-hop, electronic, classical, folk, jazz. 80 different countries are presently involved. And they read the story and the book and they figure out what of that reporting moves them. They choose the topics. And then they draw from sounds that we've collected in 7 years of reporting. So that might be machine gun fire in Somalia or chanting Cambodian deckhands on the South China Sea. Interesting textured sounds that give you a sense of place. And the musicians attempt to integrate some of that sound into their song. And then we publish the albums.
So what is the underlying ambition for the Outlaw Music Project?
There are a bunch of ambitions. One, it's just a fun, creative collaboration between two types of storytellers, if you think of a musician as a storyteller. The second is to try to commandeer platforms that aren't traditionally news platforms. So Spotify, Pandora, Apple Play, YouTube. These are platforms that have huge audiences, younger audiences, global audiences that don't typically read what I'll write for the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine, but they might be interested. And then they get curious, what's that sound? Why is it called that? What's that imagery? And they click their way over often to the story and they read the full story. There's a lot happening to counter these problems, but the problems are acute.
That was Ian Urbina, author of Outlaw Ocean, Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier, speaking with Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.